Welcome into a brand new episode of Calling It, recording Wednesday, July 7th, just before noon here in Boston. I'm Alex Barth, joined as always by Alex Lebowitz. It is the summer, so we're sort of doing the every other week thing because there's less going on. But we actually do have a good amount to talk about this week, Lebowitz. An exciting week in sports and an exciting weekend, too, coming off the 4th of July. So let's start there. How was your 4th?
It was good. I mean, it was good in the sense that I went away from home. It was bad in the sense that the weather was horrendous. I was up at Lake Winnipesaukee, Wolfboro area. Love going up there. I have a buddy who has a lake house up there. Always a good time. But it was raining for like pretty much three straight days, which kind of dampened my spirits, both literally and figuratively. And but we had Monday. So I stayed an extra day, got nice. The jet ski, got some sun. Still managed to get burnt. Very impressive feat on my part. But overall, it was nice to unwind.
Yeah, Monday was nice. So I'll say this about the weather, right? Because it was all – I was out at the beach in Nantasket, and it was gloomy for most of the day, which is unfortunate. But it cleared up for fireworks. And for me, I would – like, that was fine with me. If it's going to be gloomy, if it's going to be rainy, let that be during the day so we still get our fireworks in. Because that is like one of my favorite moments of the year. It's like the hour I spend watching fireworks on the 4th of July. Yeah. I had Freebird playing right on the speaker.
Oh, yeah.
I had an adult beverage and was just sitting back in the lounge chair on the beach watching the fireworks. So I was honestly okay with the weather because it cleared up when it needed to clear up.
And I did. You were at Nantasket Beach.
Yes.
It looked beautiful. It looked like a great setup.
So
you got to one of these days.
Yeah.
You got to go to Lake Winnipesaukee because, Sunday night is when everyone did the fireworks. And when you're on Lake Winnipesaukee, you go to a dock and the family I was staying with, they do like a ton of fireworks. They put money into it. But you don't only get those fireworks. The entire lake, you look across the lake, you have like five or six different big firework shows going on at once. And it is awesome. It really gets you in the spirit.
So Nantasket's the same way where everybody kind of lines up down the beach. It's like, I don't know, like a 4 or 5 mile long beach. And you can see in both directions, just everybody shooting them off. And you can see a couple different towns. You can see Quincy. You can see Scituate. You can see Weymouth. You can even kind of a little bit see Boston across the harbor. So it's a similar effect, but you're right. It's really cool because in every direction you look, there's fireworks. The only problem is it's random people shooting off fireworks. So we had a couple scares there on the beach on Sunday night, but everybody came out okay. And that's all that matters.
That Nantasket Beach, because I looked it up. I'm not, I'm a North Shore. I'm a Merrimack Valley guy, but I'm more North Shore when it comes to the beaches I go to. It's a really cool spot for a beach. It's kind of like out there. And it's like, I mean, theoretically, you can see Boston a little bit from there. And
there's a ferry from Boston to Nantasket.
That makes sense. It's probably a 10-minute ferry, too, if I had to guess.
Something like that. So it's a great little spot. And you're right. It's kind of hidden because if you live north of the city, you're going to any number of beaches north of the city, right? You're not going to drive through the city to go to the beach. And if you're, far enough south, you're just going to go to the Cape. It's kind of tucked in there. There's not a ton. Even if you're, in Quincy, right, you might go to Wallston instead. It's really kind of tucked in there and hidden. It's a fun spot to go to. But that's enough beach talk. Let's get into some sports here, Lebowitz. And I want to start with the Boston Red Sox because they are really freaking good. Best record in baseball. They're playing an entertaining brand of baseball. At least I believe that. I'm having fun watching them. And look at this, Lebowitz. We have a baseball summer, and I think odds are we're going to have a baseball fall, too.
It's refreshing. It really has been a blast to watch this team play. It's also vindicating because you and I were both much higher on this team at the beginning of the year. Just want to make note of that than a lot of other people. We looked at this lineup. We knew the lineup would be good. The bullpen, I don't think anyone guessed the bullpen to be as, incredible as they have been. On paper, they're not nearly as good as they've been statistically. But overall, it's been one of the best bullpens in the MLB, if not the best. Starting pitching has somehow stuck together, and that's despite the fact that Chris Sale is still, in the process of rehabbing and hopefully will be back soon. But this is a team with character. It's a team that has plenty of come-from-behind victories. They play tough. And it's somewhat reminiscent of that 2018 team, somewhat reminiscent of that 2013 team in the sense that they come from behind a ton. And it's hard not to want to root for a team like that.
Yeah, it's that's the thing, too. I think, they had some ill will to make up. Right. they've done some things in the last couple of years, obviously the Mookie Betts trade, and even though it had to happen, it hurt. It hurt as Red Sox fans. It wasn't fun to see that. This great player, this MVP who was young, who came up from through the system getting moved, you don't want to see that. And I think that they've done a great job, and they got some help from the other teams too, where, you know, the Celtics were out early. The Bruins were out relatively early. It's just been them, and they've given us reasons to believe again, which is a ton of fun. So I guess let's start there, Lubwitz. I guess which element of this team, because there's been a number of different surprises, right, from some of these acquisitions like Hunter Renfroe and Christian Arroyo playing well to the bullpen absolutely evolving, and these two former Yankees that they essentially gave up on, and Garrett Whitlock and Adam Ottavino playing key roles, to Verdugo, and I brought up the Mookie Betts trade, and he's been one of their better players. The resurgence of JD Martinez and Rafael Devers after what was a scary 2020. They seem to be responding to the return of Alex Cora. I mean, I could go on and on about all these fascinating storylines with this team, but I guess what are you the most focused on, or what have you had the most fun watching, or, you know, something from in that line?
I think the most surprising thing for me has been the bullpen and really the pitching in general. I thought this pitching rotation would be okay. I thought they'd be manageable, but mainly because I had more confidence that a guy like Eduardo Rodriguez would be serviceable. He hasn't been. He's been arguably the worst pitcher on this rotation, with the exception of maybe Garrett Richards. But I feel like Garrett Richards has shown you more promise in certain starts, even though since, you know, the Spire Tack thing, it's been a different story. But I just say the quality of the pitching so far, the bullpen has been unreal. You look at, you know, Josh Taylor. The run that guy's on is crazy. And although we've seen Matt Barnes kind of level off a little bit, he's still been a reliable closer, with Ottavino playing really well in that setup role. And then they have a number of other guys who have been able to contribute very effectively out of the bullpen. That's been great. And I think you see it in the postseason. When you have great relief pitching, it's one of the most important things that a winning team can have. So I'd say that's the most that's probably the biggest surprise for me so far.
Yeah, I mean, I was high on the bullpen at the beginning of the season. I don't think I was this high, but I was high. For me, it's, again, some of these additions, whether it be Hunter Renfroe, who's really turned it on, and he hit another home run on Tuesday night. I think Christian Arroyo's been an absolute find, and former first-round pick, guy who struggled with three different organizations, gets cut, came to Boston last year, was okay, and now this year he's really taken off. He's had some unfortunate injury issues, but again, former first round pick that they're turning around. That's Belichickian right there. And I'll give you this stat on Christian Arroyo. He's hit 5 home runs this year. All 5 have either tied the game or given the Red Sox the lead. I mean, just how awesome is that? How great is that? And then I think Verdugo's emergence has been fun too. He's cooled off a little bit after what was a great start to the season, but there's something there, and that's refreshing, because his career will ever be painted next to Mookie Betts. And I know they got other players as well, Jeter Downs and Connor Wong. And Wong had his first career major league hit last night. Downs is going to the Futures game, so those guys are doing great as well. But it's always going to be Verdugo, and seeing him play well, it, you know, it just makes that Mookie Betts trade a little bit easier to swallow.
And you mentioned a couple things. Again, I mentioned the comparison to the 2013 team. You look at a guy like Christian Arroyo, you look at a guy like Hunter Renfroe and Kike Hernandez. Are those not like three prototypical players that you'd find on that 2013 team? Like they're very similar. Veteran guys who have been around the block, who are you know, probably above average players, if not average. But they've come in the clutch multiple times. They've been pretty damn reliable. And in pretty much all their cases, they've gotten better as the season has gone on. So that's always a good sign. When you have a team that has fight, when you have a team that has character, I think that's an intangible that really, it's obviously immeasurable, but it's huge. It's huge. And you know, one guy we have yet to mention in this whole thing is Chaim Bloom, and how he has, you know, constructed a team that, although maybe he was criticized for the signings or the trades he made at the time, it's worked out. You know, the proof is in the pudding. And right now the Red Sox are the top team in the AL and have the most wins in baseball.
Well, so I want to get to Bloom in a second, but there's one other name, and that's Alex Cora. And everything you just mentioned about, you know, this team being resurgent, this team liking playing with each other, it really seems like players truly buy in when it comes to Alex Cora. And just look at last year to this year as the example, right? That team got down early last year and they kind of just quit. This year, they had that rough start. They had every excuse in the world to kind of give up, and they didn't. And you see guys like JD Martinez, you see guys like Rafael Devers turning it around, and it's hard. You can't really say that Cora has nothing to do with that. So, you know, I was on 92.9 The Ticket in Maine yesterday, and they asked me a very interesting question. If the Red Sox finish with the best record in baseball, one of the best records in baseball, win 100 games, which they're on pace to do, win the American League East, whatever it is, right? If they continue on this pace, is Major League Baseball going to give Alex Cora the AL Manager of the Year award, given he's coming off a season where he was suspended for cheating? He's going to deserve it. Mm-hmm. Then again, Barry Bonds and Roger Clemens deserve to be in the Hall of Fame. But, and we know how baseball writers are when they vote for these things, but Alex Cora is your AL Manager of the Year right now. I don't think there's any way around it.
Well, what if it went to Dusty Baker? Like, what if it went to the Astros? And because that's a dilemma too. And that,
what if it went to Tony La Russa?
Tony, that's another one.
White Sox, because he's probably the runner up right now.
Probably. I think they're going to probably try to stay away from, you know, it's the MLB. They're going to botch this in one way or another. And we still have a long season to go, of course. But that's an interesting comment. Like, how much of that award does depend on, you know, how it will reflect on the MLB, especially when they've had so many allegations of kind of enabling the culture of cheating in its own sport. So that's an interesting question. But I'll tell you this. I don't think there's another manager in the MLB that I'd rather have than Alex Cora, specifically for this team, but probably in general too. And you look at the Yankees and their situation, both in the front office and in the dugout with Aaron Boone and Brian Cashman. That's a disaster. That's a nightmare. The fact that the Red Sox recovered the way that they did after that 2020 season, you know, losing Alex Cora, the scandal that ensued, and Dombrowski kind of leaving this team in a bit of a mess, it's staggering. And it really is especially crazy when you look at the past 10 years and you've looked at this pattern for the Red Sox, where they've gone from, you know, a dog shit team that can't win anything, finishes, you know, fourth in the division and is so hard to root for, to one of the best teams in baseball and potentially World Series favorites. This isn't the first time it's happened. It's not even the second time it's happened. This pattern's crazy. And, you know, I honestly know we mentioned it before, but I don't know what else to make of it at this point.
Yeah, it's just a really interesting situation, I think, across, you know, the AL East. And we'll see how that sorts out. I did want to touch on Chaim Bloom at the deadline. You want to see him go all in? Would you move prospects? Bloom keeps saying that he wants to build a team that can win multiple titles and can contend every year. You need prospects to do that. How all in do you want to see the Red Sox get?
You know, I think that they could definitely add defensively. I know everyone always, you know, loves the outfield and how good their arms are. Hunter Renfroe, Kike Hernandez, JD Martinez, they've all had outfield assists this year. When it comes to actually tracking down fly balls, there's a lot of room for improvement, in my opinion, from at least what I've seen. And I think the numbers reflect that. So I don't know if that's the highest priority for me. The number one thing I think they need to address, even with Chris Sale coming back, is bringing in another starter, maybe like a Nate Eovaldi like they did in 2018, a Jake Peavy like they did in 2013, somebody who can come in and you know what you're going to get out of him. Not an ace necessarily, but a guy who you're not going to have to unload too much for, but will definitely fill a void for this team. So I'm looking at that starting rotation as a place that I'd want to address if I were Bloom.
I think the starting rotation too, I think, you know, a hybrid first base corner outfielder might help. You mentioned Nathan Eovaldi. You know, you go back to the 2018 team and their two deadline additions, Nathan Eovaldi and Steve Pierce. And I think that's, they kind of need to make those moves again. I'd love to see him go out and get like a Max Scherzer, right? And that would be great. Or Craig Kimbrell. And that would be awesome. But I just don't know that that's the move Chaim Bloom is looking to make, and I don't know that they need that kind of move. I think if they add a couple pieces for mid-tier prospects, which should be on the table for this team, right? I get that you want to rebuild the farm system, and it's still not in a great place after Dave Dombrowski, but I think the Red Sox really have a chance to win a title this year, and I'll move on from the 15th, 20th ranked prospect in the organization to do that, because is there a great team in the American League right now? I don't think there is. It was supposed to be the Yankees. And they still objectively probably have the best roster, but they're not performing up to it. So you write them off.
Chicago's, I say the Astros.
So the Astros are good, but they're not what those Astros teams were. And they, you know, they've lost Carlos Correa. They've lost some of these pieces. They're good, but I don't, you know, I'm not overly worried about them. Again, if the Red Sox make a move or two, I think their roster's right on par with Houston's. Chicago's a good team, but they're young, right? Are they going to hit that wall? I'd say the same thing about Toronto. They certainly have talent, but can they get over the hump as young as they are?
Are you done with the Rays? Do you think the spider tech thing ruined
it? Yeah, so the Rays, they lose Glass now. They strike out. They're top five in the majors in strikeouts. I think they've locked into a lot of success so far. I don't think what they're doing is sustainable. So the Red Sox right now, I put them maybe right below the Astros, but they're certainly close in terms of the best roster in the American League. They make a couple moves at the deadline. They're clearly the best roster in the American League. And, you know, I don't know that there's a path to them becoming a better team and on paper than the Dodgers. I don't know that they're going to have a better roster than the Padres, the Giants maybe. But the point is, when you get to that final round, if you can get to the World Series, anything can happen. So I think they need to make some moves because get themselves to the World Series, and then who knows what happens.
And again, I think that this team is constructed very well for the playoffs in the sense that they have plenty of guys who can play a bunch of different positions when it comes to their position players. And, you know, even if their fourth and fifth starters are shaky, you shorten your rotation anyway in the postseason. And they have a great bullpen to work with, which is going to give them a bit of a safety net. So it's not as much about, you know, which is the most stacked, talented team, you know, in the league. How are they constructed? I think this Red Sox team is constructed in a really, really good manner that is perfect for playoff baseball. And that's not to say that they shouldn't make a move or two. I agree wholeheartedly with what you said, but they're in a great position, you know, right now as of today.
All right. N'Keal Harry wants a trade, apparently. His agent released a statement through Mike Garofalo of NFL Network yesterday. Some strong wording in there. And I don't think he was entirely wrong in some of the things he said, and I'll pull up the statement here, but it was just, I don't know who else he reps on the Patriots, but I can't imagine Bill Belichick was overly thrilled about the way that was put. Here is the statement from his agent, Jamal Tuzin. For the past several months, I have been working in cooperation with the Patriots behind the scenes to put a plan in place to allow N'Keal to thrive in New England. Through two seasons, he has 86 targets, which obviously hasn't met the expectations the Patriots and N'Keal had when they drafted a dominant downfield threat who was virtually unstoppable at the point of attack in college. Following numerous conversations with the Patriots, I believe it's time for a fresh start and best for both parties if N'Keal moves on before the start of training camp. That is why I have informed the Patriots today I am formally requesting a trade on behalf of my client. And then he goes on to say some more stuff about, you know, N'Keal expects to be a great player and will continue to work. So here's the part that stands out, Lewis, right? They drafted a dominant downfield threat who was virtually unstoppable at the point of attack in college. And he's saying the Patriots haven't met the expectations. There's some truth there. Point of attack, he's a great player. We saw it at times last year. Downfield threat, you need to be fast to be a downfield threat. But this kind of goes to the heart of the problem. N'Keal Harry certainly didn't succeed. Based on the Pro Football Reference approximated value stat, he's the worst first-round pick in team history. But the Patriots didn't use him correctly. They tried to turn him into something he's not. This is a team that for years, their hallmark has been putting players in position to play to their strengths. They had N'Keal Harry playing to his weaknesses. I'm not convinced N'Keal Harry's a bust. He may go somewhere else and find moderate success. I know he's going to be a Pro Bowler. I don't know that he's going to be an All-Pro, but I think he can be a contributor. And this, to me, is more about the Patriots than it is about N'Keal Harry.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, I don't think he was utilized in the best way, but a player performs, and you know, you should be versatile enough to at least pick your spots. And it seemed like even that was difficult. And when he did have his opportunities, he showed you that he was really raw, and he was not a guy who was at the NFL level. They talk about his size, his agent. He's huge. He's big. He's strong. He didn't play physically at all. He didn't play nearly as physically as he should have during his Patriots tenure. He was somebody who that was a big, you know, that was something people attacked him for constantly, and rightfully so. Obviously, the development of a rookie comes down to partially the team. And a lot of that does fall on Belichick for mishandling him and mismanaging him. But I think the real onus falls on Belichick simply for drafting him in the first place. It wasn't a fit. And I don't understand why they would bring a guy in who is a specific type of player, try to change him into something he's not, as you mentioned, and then just continue to force that relationship. It's going to inevitably lead to what it has, which is him demanding a trade, and his value is shot, so there's nothing you can get for him. But either way, I think the writing was on the wall. I'm curious to see if they can even deal him. I think this is probably going to end up in him being released realistically, because what leverage do the Patriots have here? Either way, though, I would say this is probably one of the worst, if not the worst, draft picks that Belichick has ever used.
So I wrote about this for 98.5 The Sports Hub this morning. You can check it out, 98.5thesportshub.com. I actually do think the Patriots can move N'Keal Harry. I think a guy who was a first-round pick just 2 years ago, and there were teams that were supposedly interested in him other than the Patriots, I think somebody's going to see it as a bargain and a chance to turn a player around, right? We've seen the Patriots do this with players time and time again. And we know that there was interest. There was reportedly interest during both free agency and the trade deadline. Washington, Arizona were teams that called and checked in. To me, it comes down to what they're looking to do with the trade. You're not going to get a return. You're not going to get the return for your investment if you're the Patriots, obviously. But, you know, people are throwing out these player for player trades. Can you trade him for Andy Isabella? Can you trade him for Greedy Williams? I don't know that that's the best course to go, because this roster's, in terms of depth, is stacked. The top end talent maybe isn't what the traditional Patriots teams have been, but the depth is outrageous. They're going to end up cutting good players. Are you going to trade N'Keal Harry for a guy who isn't a lock to make the team? That's just not a wise investment. But I think if you're looking, instead of player for player, a player for pick, or a player for picks, or a pick swap, where it's, you know, just pulling this off the top of my head, N'Keal Harry and a sixth round pick for a fourth round pick, something like that, there's value there. There absolutely is, because you push that projection, you know, you push that roster spot down the road when maybe it's not as competitive. You get to pick your guy in the replacement. I think, or you can use that pick as an asset to move up. So they're not going to get a ton for him. A day three pick is the absolute max, but could you get a fifth or sixth round pick for N'Keal Harry? Yeah, I think that that's a possibility. I think it is, and I think they could do a lot worse. So the question is, when do they do it? Do they risk having him come into camp? Because if he performs poorly, or if he holds out, that's going to tank his value. But if he has a strong camp, then, you know, obviously they can get more for him. Does he want that? I'm sure, you know, he wants to start fresh with his new team at the start of camp, so he can get on the same page as everybody. So that's the question right now. But I do think that they could get something for N'Keal Harry.
Yeah, I'm sure. I think what you mentioned, that's probably the peak of it. Trading N'Keal in a late round pick for like a fourth. That's the peak. When it comes to, you know, trading player for player, first of all, it doesn't seem to happen all that often in the NFL. It's not, especially for guys at this level. It's you know, more common you're going to see them go for a specific pick. Also, one more factor here, although he's not making a lot of money, but the cap hit, I'm looking it up right now, 2.7 like, million.
Right.
So if they did unload him and a pick for another pick, you open up 2.7 million. They're still negotiating with Stephon Gilmore. Not that I think that that's the difference, or that that's going to like cause us to.
No.
But it gives you a little breathing room. And gives Belichick a little bit more flexibility. Either way, I don't think N'Keal Harry, I don't know if he was going to be on this team week one anyway. I think the writing's been on the wall, and I'm sure that Belichick was probably looking for some sort of exit strategy. Maybe not. Maybe I'm wrong. But I didn't see a fit for him on this team, especially when you brought in Kendrick Bourne, Nelson Aguilar, and revamped your tight end core. Where's he going to fit? So this is going to be best for both sides. And I think, and I also understand the agent's perspective. I don't fault him for trying to get his client out of there. It's not working. The relationship's gone sour. The relationship never really went off at all. And I, you know, I truly, I hope that he finds a better fit and that he can be a somewhat serviceable guy. But right now, as of today, he's a bust. Biggest bust Belichick's ever had, in my opinion.
Yeah, I mean, I had him off the roster on my projection. Yeah, if you want to call him a bust, but I think he's more a bust because of Belichick than because of himself for, whatever that.
Well, I'm
generally somebody who defends Belichick in the draft. I think he's made a lot more good picks than people give him credit for. N'Keal Harry's not one of them.
Of course. And there's also several guys picked after him at that same position. I know this is brought up all the time and, by the Captain Hindsight's of the world. I'm going to be Captain Hindsight right now. Obviously, you had several guys in that draft that at that position, at least two or three, who have been much better than N'Keal Harry, if I'm not mistaken. And you went with the wrong guy. He just did. And people will defend Belichick for his drafting record. I think you should. At every other position besides wide receiver, that's clearly been the weak spot for him when it comes to analyzing that position. At least with cornerback, when he's done poorly, at the first few rounds at picking that position, he's made up for it with the undrafted guys. And you could bring up Jacoby Myers when it comes to the wide receiving corps. But besides that,
Julian Edelman in the seventh round.
Edelman, but Julian Edelman was such a gimmicky pick. Because you're like, let's try to bring this guy who's a quarterback at Kent State. Like, that's like a Belichickian pick late in the draft. I think that's a different ballgame. But overall, you take out those two guys, it's been garbage. It's been garbage at that position. And fortunately, he's been able to, bring in other people and he's been able to put the pieces together. Obviously, he's had a great career. But that's always going to be the bad spot for Belichick when it comes to drafting. Always.
So I would say, he hasn't had success, but just to play devil's advocate here, because I do believe some of this, he hasn't drafted a ton of wide receivers early. So not like he's had a ton of chances to succeed. The Patriots offense doesn't do him any favors, especially in the last 10 years where the college game has moved so far from what the NFL game is. And the Patriots have become such a traditional NFL offense where you bring these guys in, these rookies, you're asking them, it's like they're learning a whole new sport. So again, that's less about the player and more about what the team is asking them to do. With that draft, specifically the 2019 draft, I don't fault them for Metcalf. There were legitimate concerns about Metcalf. He's obviously since proved them wrong, but he went in the second round. 32 teams passed on him. Metcalf, I don't fault him for. AJ Brown, I do a little bit. I think he would have been a good fit. But Terry McLaurin is always the one who gets me. He was a fourth round pick, so it's not as valuable of a pick. He's a guy who fit their mold, right? When they drafted N'Keal Harry, they were trying to break their mold and get a new kind of player. And there's always an inherent risk in that. And I get wanting to do that. But Terry McLaurin was a guy where he checked all the boxes of the kind of receivers who had succeeded in New England before. He also had a lot of special teams experience. He was a guy who could have contributed right away on special teams. McLaurin was the guy. That's the pick that you could talk about DK all you want. That's being Captain Hindsight. Taking DK 32nd overall that year would have been a weird pick. Taking Terry McLaurin in the third or fourth round was the pick they should have made that they didn't make in that draft. And by the way, they could have doubled up at wide receiver too. They could have taken N'Keal Harry and Terry McLaurin. So that's the one that's always going to bug me.
Yeah, and we've seen him take risk before. So I guess the question I have is, why take this risk and not that? When Rob Gronkowski sticks out, guy with an injury history who fell in the draft because of his back problems, ended up being a pretty damn good player. What was it that you saw in Gronkowski that maybe you didn't see in a DK Metcalf?
And, so I think with Metcalf, it was beyond the injury stuff. It was the ability to operate in more NFL concepts right outside of that offense that Ole Miss was running. And he had a lot of the same red flags N'Keal Harry did coming in. If they draft DK Metcalf, I don't know that he's this 1,000-yard wide receiver all pro that he's been in Seattle. He's probably better than Harry, but he's probably closer to average than, again, because I think this is as much about the team as it is the player. I don't think DK Metcalf becomes DK Metcalf if the Patriots take him. Same with N'Keal Harry. I think if N'Keal Harry goes to Seattle, I don't know that he's putting up DK Metcalf's numbers. But I certainly don't think he's demanding a trade 2 years into his career.
There's one other factor, too, which is, he started out with Tom Brady. And Tom Brady, he has his guys. And if he trusts you, you're in the circle. And if he doesn't, he's not going to pick on you as much. It's just the nature of the game with probably any quarterback, but that's especially true of Tom Brady. You go from that, one of the greatest quarterback, the greatest quarterback of all time, to Cam Newton, who, you know, did not have a great year last year. He stayed healthy. He did what he had to do, I guess, but he's not the greatest arm in the NFL. It wasn't a good situation for a young guy who is still trying to, right, you know, find his bearings in the NFL. And, you know, you could look at Tom Brady and say, maybe he didn't do enough to mentor this guy and get him to where he needs to be. And that might be nitpicking. It might be unfair, but I think these are all factors that worked against N'Keal Harry and ultimately led to the situation we're in now.
All right, let's do real quick here. NBA Finals game one last night, Suns Bucks. Chris Paul took over. I'm rooting for the Suns. I think this is a really fun team. I like Devin Booker as a player. I think Chris Paul getting a title would be cool. I love the idea that the Suns would prove having a dominant traditional center still matters, right? In DeAndre Ayton, and he's made a massive difference for this team throughout this playoff run. I also just I can't get behind the Bucks. I really can't. So, who are you rooting for in this series?
Yeah, you got to root for the Suns. I think all of America is rooting for the Suns, and that's not even because I'm anti-Bucks. Obviously, kind of a rival to the Celtics. That, I mean, historically they are, and right now they certainly are as well. So you got to go with the Western Conference team. If it was the Lakers, I wouldn't be saying that. But the Suns team is fun to root for. You look at Devin Booker, who's had so many question marks surrounding him throughout his career, despite the fact that he's been one of the best scorers in the NBA for the past few years. He's proven a lot of people wrong. Chris Paul is probably number one on the list, though, a guy who has paid his dues, one of the most well-respected players in the NBA. And obviously this opportunity for him is overdue. And then you mentioned Ayton. But overall, I do like the series simply because it's changing the landscape of the NBA. I wanted the Nets just to not make it. That was my only goal. I didn't care about LeBron James. I didn't care about anything else other than the Nets not making it to the NBA Finals. We're here now, and although, you know, these ratings are probably going to be the worst the NBA Finals has seen in quite some time, it's exciting as a fan to see something different and to watch an atypical team, really two atypical teams, in a spot that I don't think anyone envisioned them being.
Yeah, and I think the NBA needs more like this. I'm just watching last night, and it just hits you like, oh, Phoenix is in the NBA Finals. That's kind of cool. You really wouldn't have thought of that. So I don't know about the ratings thing. I think they might do okay because they still have Giannis. I think people are interested in Chris Paul. It's not LeBron. You're right. But at a certain, I get that ratings are important. I'm trying to figure out how to phrase this because I get you need the ratings. But,
Let me ask you this. Do you think if the Nets were in this finals, they'd have better ratings than the Bucks, probably, right?
Oh, that one, I don't know. I think if anything, the Suns are the one pulling the ratings out. Maybe not. I think internationally, Giannis is a great draw.
Yeah,
this,
for sure.
This is great for the NBA's international market, obviously. And I don't think a lot of people like the Nets. I don't remember. They had to pay people to come to their games or whatever that was.
Well,
right?
That's so, the thing. They have the international appeal with the superstars, but their local fan base stinks. They have seven fans. So it's a much different makeup, but I do wonder how would the attention surrounding this, I feel like outside of like the NBA circle, like NBA fans, people who already pay attention, no one really even knows that it's the finals right now. It almost feels like the Stanley Cup finals, because that also gets far too little attention as well.
This year's Cup finals just sucks.
It's brutal. I mean, at least the Canadians aren't. You know, I know that a lot of people want the Lightning.
I don't. I can't believe people are rooting for the Habs. It's you know brutal. What? I get it. Screw Tampa. They took Tom Brady. They've been winning a bunch of Stanley Cups, which they don't deserve because they're in a warm weather climate. They cheated the salary cap, all of that. But at the end of the day, they built a good team. They were inevitable. I was already mentally accepting the fact that they were probably going to win the cup. I that was it. I had accepted it. I'd come to terms with it. I'm not going to root for Montreal. Those fans that called the police on Zdeno Chara. And yeah, the team is interesting. Cole Caulfield's a neat player. I get it. I like the roster. I do. But I don't want those fans to be happy. Those fans do not deserve happiness. Those fans do not deserve to know what it feels like to see their team hoist a Stanley Cup. So DeRozan's neat. Awesome. I'm not rooting for that team because I cannot support that fan base having smiles on their faces.
Well, and I'll say this too. If a team, if Florida team wins a championship and no one's around to celebrate it, did it really happen?
Exactly.
Like they like, because for sports fandom, for I think the vast majority of people, whether they want to admit it or not, you don't hate the team that you claim to hate. You hate the fan base of that team. You know, I don't like Yankee fans far more than I don't like the Yankees, if that makes any sense. And yes. I don't want people in Montreal, those snobs. I don't want them winning. I don't want anyone in the country of Canada to win a Stanley Cup. I just don't. I know they're nice people. They're probably great. I don't like the fan base of the Montreal Canadiens. I hate them. The Tampa Bay fan base does not exist. Therefore, I am indifferent about that team.
Lebowitz, me and you have a number of mutual friends who are Islanders fans, right? And some of whom have been on this show. When the Islanders beat the Bruins, I was more upset that those people were happy about sports than I was that the Bruins lost. Yep. Those people do not – they are Islanders fans. They are Jets fans. Those people do not deserve sports happiness. And that – great friends. Don't get me wrong. Plenty of happiness in their personal lives. As sports fans, they deserve nothing but misery, and anything else feels wrong.
Yeah,
and I'm sure they feel the same way about us.
Sure. Well, I think they're numb. From my impression,
that's true.
They're not. Because we have a mutual friend who's a Rangers fan, and he hates his thinking is like the Patriots could win the next 5 years, and he doesn't care because he's so numb to the Patriots. He's also a Jets fan. He's so numb to the Patriots continuously winning in the NFL and having the success. He hates the New York Islanders way worse than he hates the Red Sox, way worse than he hates the Yankees, way worse than he hates worse than he hates the Patriots. Every Boston team pales in comparison in regard to his disdain compared to the New York Islanders. And it's not because of the history. It's not because of this player. It's because of the fans. He just hates the fans. And that is, I mean, without the fans, like, sports is far less interesting because
there is
it's
no
drama.
Sports without the fans.
Absolutely. It's cliche. But I'm saying it for a different reason. There's still sports. You still have baseball. You still have Little League. There's no fans there. But there's no the interest that comes with it. There's obviously the level of talent that you have in these leagues and the you know how skilled of athletes these guys are. But overall, it's you know the passion and again the disdain you have towards people who root for a different team than you. I think that's one thing that college sports kind of. You know, that's what gives college sports the life that it has as much as the skill level, obviously. So, yeah, long story short, screw the Canadians. If you're rooting for the Canadians and you claim you're a Boston sports fan, shame on you.
All right. Couple quick final thoughts here. I want to get in. If you want to get us started, go ahead.
Which I start. Oh, I think you should leave. Back on Air. Netflix. Watch it. It's good. I've seen the first four episodes. They're only 15 minutes long. So it's really easy to crush. One of my favorite shows of the past 3 years. This season, it's good. I was worried it would disappoint. It hasn't. It might not be as good as last season, but it's great. Go watch that if you get the chance.
So what was mine? I had a good one, my final thought, and I can't remember what it was.
Okay, so we had, let's see. There was the match. I don't think that was your final thought.
Yeah, I have no interest. I have no interest in those. I didn't watch yesterday. It doesn't do it for me. It just really doesn't.
Yeah. You know what? It's a lot worse when Tiger Woods is not involved. Oh, I know what your final thought was. Nick Castellanos.
That's right. Thank you. So Nick Castellanos hit another poorly timed home run over the weekend in Kansas City to deep left field as the broadcast was eulogizing a World War II veteran. Nick Castellanos is so great for baseball, and it's beyond the poorly timed home runs. He's a great player. He plays with a ton of emotion. He's doing goofy things when he flexed on that pitcher. I don't know if you saw, he did an interview a couple of months ago after he got suspended where they asked him about the suspension, and he gave the headset, right, for the post-game interview to a fan so the fan could call Rob Manfred a bum so Castellanos wouldn't get punished.
That's so great.
The guy is just awesome. So huge fan of Nick Castellanos. Actually, I have two more final thoughts here because these happened as we were doing the show, Lebowitz. First off, grab your phone, go on Twitter real quick and search Kurt Warner.
Oh, geez.
I don't know if you've seen this as we're talking about it. So apparently they're making a movie about Kurt Warner's life, and maybe it'll be interesting. I don't know. He has an interesting story for sure. One of the more unique NFL Hall of Famers, one of the more unique Super Bowl champions. But the football scenes in this movie just look absolutely brutal. They look horrible. Just down to the uniforms, they look like cheap knockoffs you'd get at Walmart. And the guy they have playing Kurt Warner is like, I don't know if he's fat or did they put like a bunch of recording equipment under his jersey? It looks like he's shoplifting. So this
is the guy who played Chuck. I know this guy.
Is he? I don't really know that much about it. It looks very stupid. It looks very dumb. It just proves it's so hard to make a good football movie.
He was Shazam. He was Chuck and he was Shazam. He's a good actor. He does not look like a football player. He looks really, I'm looking at this now. He doesn't look good in football pads at all. He does not look.
He looks like he's wearing a bodysuit.
He does. And it looks like his stomach's kind of jutting out a little bit. And he just doesn't look good. He doesn't look like an athlete. Like, at least like Kurt Warner looks like a football player, you know? He's got the look. He's got the whole appeal. This guy doesn't. And yeah, I'm watching these scenes.
Well, the jersey, ooh. The jersey's not helping.
Definitely. Oh, and of course, Dennis Quaid's in this movie.
As Dick Vermeil, yep.
This is, I don't know. My question is, who's going to be who's going to play Tom Brady? If they're making a movie out of Kurt Warner, although he has a great life story, obviously.
I'm going to guess the movie cuts short after that. The movie cuts off, or sorry, before that. They're not going to show that. We'll save that for the Brady movie.
If they ever do because Brady's all about the content, they're going to make a movie. They're going to make like an actual movie about Tom Brady.
So I've said this for a while. I don't think this would actually happen. This was also years ago. There's a picture of Jesse Eisenberg, the guy who played Mark Zuckerberg in The Social Network.
Oh, yeah.
If you go on Google Images, the first picture of Jesse Eisenberg, he kind of looks like a young Tom Brady. Now, this picture's 10 years old. He doesn't look like that anymore. Jesse Eisenberg, I think, is also under 6 feet tall. So that certainly doesn't help, right? You can't
He's
have
five,
a guy
seven.
Playing Tom Brady who's right. 5'7", shorter than I am. So it wouldn't work, but he looks remarkably like Tom Brady in that picture. I don't know who's going to play Tom Brady. It's going to be a tough one. Brady might just do it.
Well, it depends. What age are we talking here? I think that would be an important factor. Channing Tatum. I mean, I'm thinking of like athletic people, but he doesn't look like a Tom Brady at all.
You might need multiple people.
Well, if you're doing a life story, you definitely would. It's also, there's also an issue, like the guy playing Kurt Warner, he seems tall. He looks like he's at least 6'3", 6'4", you know, even though he doesn't have the build, the body type, I guess, to be a quarterback or whatever. He looks tall. Jesse Eisenberg mentioned it, 5'7". There's no way that guy's going to be a quarterback in a movie. Who are some tall actors who could potentially play that role? Vince Vaughn, if he was 20 years younger, could do it. I think
it's got no, because he doesn't have the fight. You got to it's got to be a fiery actor. It's got to be somebody. Vince Vaughn's going to be yelling, "Let's go. Come on."
Oh, like, yeah. Vince Vaughn's a fiery guy. Come on.
I can't see it.
He was in Rudy, too. He's played a football player.
I just think of him in Dodgeball.
No, you got to think of him. Wedding Crashers. He was fiery in that. He was definitely the A-type alpha guy. You know, if you're comparing him to Owen Wilson. Right. So
I think Brady, but it's like a quiet fire. I think Brady's going to do it himself.
Maybe he plays himself. I think that would be I don't think he's a good actor. Maybe he has Peyton Manning claim.
That would be hilarious. Well, Peyton Manning will definitely play himself in the Tom Brady movie. I could see that.
I'm sure.
No, go ahead.
So and that's one thing. I feel like you don't see that as much these days. You get certain stories about certain athletes. You know, you have Cinderella Man and you have, 42 and all of these other stuff, but you don't get a lot of movies about somewhat modern athletes, at least people who have retired within the last 20 years. Also, they never made one about Bo Jackson. So what's the deal with that?
That's a good point. They should make a Bo Jackson. Have a very sad ending.
It would. I mean, it could and it couldn't. I mean, you don't think he's probably has some peace of mind at this point. So,
true. Is there a Ted Williams movie?
Is there a Ted Williams movie?
There should be. That would be a good one.
Ted Williams would be a great – I mean, that incredibly interesting life story. Oh, you also have 61, which is a good one. So there are a bunch of them. We should do that one day, though. Make a list of athletes that they need to make movies about.
I'll give you one about. That they shouldn't, that they're absolutely going to.
Oh, God. LeBron James.
Tebow. I'm dreading the Tim Tebow movie. Because you know it's coming.
I think Tebow's jumped the shark. I think people don't like him at all. And I think his popularity
still has that loyal. They're going to make a movie about him and it's going to be obnoxious.
He's so annoying. I'm so done with Tim Tebow. He's going to try to use every relationship he has to just prolong his career undeservedly. It's ridiculous. It's ridiculous at this point. Get in the booth, go in the booth and commentate and make your millions of dollars that way. It's ridiculous. I'm sorry.
One more final thought here, Lebowitz.
Yep.
Does the name Ever Given ring a bell?
Ever Given.
Remember what this is?
I don't know what we're talking about.
That was the ship that was stuck in the Suez Canal. It has officially left after 106 days.
It was still there?
Yeah. So it wasn't stuck. It was off to the side. But they were holding on to it because there were issues about who was going to pay to fix the damages. But I guess they got that figured out. So it is now gone. It has left the Suez Canal. It is finally on its way. I certainly hope there are no perishables on board.
God, what a disaster that was. Good. I'm glad it's gone. Widen that canal. Make sure that you don't get anything stuck there anymore. Billions of dollars. Crazy that a canal that's, you know, the length of a football field, if that, not even. Could be that impactful to our global economy. That makes you feel really, really good inside. You're going to sleep well tonight.
That was a fun week, though.
A fun week. Great content, at least. The global economy was crashing, but the content was A1. It's amazing.
I will be back, next week, 2 weeks. Actually, yeah, let's try to get a show in next week because I want to talk about the Derby.
Well, we could also, yeah, and then we have the Home Run Derby. Yeah, 5 Red Sox, by the way. What is it? Bogarts, Devers, Martinez, Barnes, and Eovaldi, all in the All-Star game, which is going to be fun to watch.
So we'll have a lot to talk about. We'll get a show in next week. In the meantime, follow us on Twitter at Calling It Podcast and check us out online at clnsmedia.com under the podcast tab. Until then, for Alex Lebowitz, I'm Alex Barth. Thanks for listening.